I'm delighted to introduce you to our newest supporting sponsor, a team human enabler in more ways than one, Groucho. Groucho's a platform that answers the most common question we get at Team Human: how do I find the others? Well, this is it. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman, share your interests and aspirations, and Groucho's curators will hand assemble a real dinner club for you. You meet twice a month in order to establish some lasting friendships. Groucho takes care of all the logistics. The thing I like is that it was built by artists, not tech pros, people who wanted to recreate what they got from artist residencies, curated intentionally, and with time and space to connect. That's how the founders met their own best collaborators, friends, and even life partners. So check out mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Find the others. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to live fully and beautifully, even in a world that is collapsing around us. It's time to embrace the apocalypse, or at least one another. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, social philosopher, podcaster, and author of beloved books, including First We Make the Beast Beautiful and This One Wild and Precious Life, Sarah Wilson. We're celebrating her new book, I Eat the Stars, How to Live Fully and Beautifully in a Collapsing World. Systemic failure never felt so good. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. Well, hey, Sarah, a couple of months ago, I had the honor of being on your podcast, Wild, and I felt in pretty perfect alignment, as if we were talking on my own podcast. And it felt as if we've been on the same course over the last few decades, tracing the imminent collapse of this civilization and developing an approach to metabolizing this change, kind of serving as death doulas to this world and birth doulas to the next. But lately, it's been feeling really good to do that. And I guess I'm wondering, first off, is that okay?
Yeah, I reckon it is. By the way, lovely to see your face again. Like, it is always such a joy. It is such a joy to come across, I don't know, other people on Team Human who are in this. And Doug, I really like the word metabolize, and I think it's a word that more of us are using. It really lands perfectly, because I think anyone listening to this who's been in some kind of quote-unquote fight, you know, climate fight, fight against injustice, I think we've all reached a point where it's so thoroughly exhausting, because it's us versus them. And what we're doing is we're taking part in the same kind of mindset that landed us in the trouble in the first place.
Yeah.
Us versus them, this incredible separation. It's not a resignation at all. It's a peaceful dropping into a next stage, which is, as you say, we are hospicing something. We are doulas. You know, we are taking what is decaying into something else. It's composting through us, right? It's metabolizing through us, because we are part of all of this. You know, we're not separate from it. Mm. And I think we've known this, we've talked about it, we've read the spiritual texts that sort of are adjacent to the climate fight or the equity fight that we've been doing for years. But I think we're now starting to embody it. I sense there's a new stage that we're entering. There's a bunch of us entering into it, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this could be feeling the same way. So hopefully we can touch sort of a trigger point there for everyone.
I mean, because I can share, you know, we tried to do this a couple of weeks ago. There was a calendar issue, and then I just got back from a week-long shamanic workshop in Costa Rica. And it was my first anything like a vacation since 1999. You know, when Y2K, the bug, was going to happen and all the planes were going to crash, I went to Tortola for 2 weeks, figuring that would be a good place to be if everything broke. And I haven't done it, partly just because I've been working really hard, but partly out of some kind of lefty guilt that there's so much work to be done. How dare I be a wealthy white elitist going off and just doing self-care, right? But I had such a profound sense that the universe or the gods or Gaia had my back. You know, they gave so many signs when I was worried about something of like, well, here, you know, everything worked so perfectly. And even the things that were bad things were such perfectly timed provocations of my shadow, you know, that I was exactly ready to deal with each of the bad things as they came and to transform them into, projections or things I'm participating. I felt myself really going from victim of my problems to creator of my problems in seconds. And
yeah,
it's like, I know it's valuable. I know I'm a better activist. I know I'm more, I can metabolize more global trauma now than I could before, but I still, part of me feels, are we allowed to feel good about what we're doing when there's so much awful happening?
Yeah, we have to for a whole bunch of reasons. You know, this is the dance that I have been in as well. And I think we've got a responsibility to role model the fuck out of this. We've got to actually show that the new way of being, the sort of the stepping into the new world that is going to have to come after all of this. You know, we're going to have to rebuild, recreate, or just create something. We're already doing it, right? We're already co-creating it. But we need to, those of us who are sort of in the space where we've let go to a certain extent of the old world, we do need to look as though we're enjoying this new thing. We've got to make it look sexier than the status quo, right? Otherwise, right, it'll never gel. But I really do believe in what I call a stunning possibility. And the stunning possibility is that we could create, and we are creating, we're already there creating something that is actually a bit of a return to our humanity. We have got so off pissed with who we are. You know, the neoliberal system has dragged us away. We've been yearning for it. We've got to actually go and find these pockets of joy and showcase them. And so anything that gets us closer to our mission, you know, our journey here as a human, but also shows us how we have to be part of the matrix of life, you know, interconnected with life and nature. Those two things are really important. So they're the solution as well, right? This is how we are going to build the future.
Right.
This is the future we want to build. I don't want to go back to a post-industrial civilization, early post-industrialization. I do not want to go back to that. I do not want to get off on the 1 degree off-pissed kind of direction where we end up, you know, way off course after 200 years. No, we need to actually get this right.
Because on the simplest level, if your metabolism is happy, if you're closer to the state of the happy Buddha, I mean, you can metabolize a heck of a lot more of the trauma around you. And it's oddly more sensitive and intolerant of the things that are pulling us away. You know, I came back and was talking about my experience with someone, and his phone kept dinging with whatever interruptions were coming. And a few minutes in, I was like, oh, well, this isn't the time to talk about this, because I started to experience each interruption as such a violation of my presence, you know, so it's a violation of my joy, my presence, my being in the moment. And it's good on that level. But on the other, I love what you're saying about, you know, we want people to ultimately to follow their bliss, that they're going to do this. They're going to move to a more horizontal, less growth-based, whatever we want to call it, industrial capitalist model, if it looks more fun. Oh, you mean it's more fun to hang out with your friends and make love and do permaculture farming than it is to make $1 zillion on the stock market? Yeah, turns out it is.
Yeah, Margaret Wheatley is she's referred to on the cover of her books. She writes about the idea of building islands of sanity. You know, we've got to build these islands of sanity where people, as they start to kind of step into a type of collapse awareness, have somewhere to go. Right? They can see beacons out there who are getting on with the next way of being that is delightful, you know? And so that's the work I think that we're, a lot of people are starting to do at the moment.
Why is there pain and suffering in this world, right? You know?
Yeah. And, you know, we have to live, we all have to live as fully as we can within the confines that we've been given. And so if we've been given broad boundaries, we need to go and step out into that space and see what we can do to further the human experience.
And I'm not trying to sound egotistical or even to justify, but when I look at your career, it helps me because you've been through, over the last 10 or 15 years, going through the same process that I have, which began, I mean, it began with kind of a diagnosis of the present.
Well, you know where it began? It began being firmly ensconced in the most mainstream domain ever. I mean, I was a, you know, I was a mainstream journalist for 20 odd years. You know, I was the editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan magazine. I mean, honestly. And, you know, I was a columnist for Rupert Murdoch at the age of 22, I think it was. So I've come from that, right? Well, I've seen, you know, the dark side, you might want to call it.
The dark side, yet for however dark side it was, at the moment, Helen Gurley Brown starting Cosmopolitan and the Cosmopolitan girl, however silly it sounds to us today, was the beginning of a revolution.
Totally. And she was my mentor. You know, she's the person that gave me the job. I sat on the leopard print covered staircase in her home facing Central Park and just sitting on the steps with her at a party where it was her job to determine whether I would become editor or not. I was 29, had never read the magazine in my life. I had never worn high heel shoes or makeup. And she saw all of that and went, yeah, you can do this job. But yeah, I was at the tail end of that sort of magazines being a space for women to get some empowerment messaging, and left it, you know, just as it all got really, really ugly and social media arrived and all of that kind of thing. But the point being, I've sort of come from that and then I've done this wild experiment to go, well, what was all of that about? And, you know, that background enabled me to bring along a mainstream audience into the kinds of conversations you and I are having. I mean, that's kind of what I feel is the important work to do, because there's a lot of people out there who are super smart, who have got really sensitive nervous systems, but have been, for all kinds of reasons, enthralled, you know, by the capitalist system, as we all have been at various times in our lives. And they need somewhere to go. You know, they need to have the kinds of conversations that used to guide humanity in the past have been wiped off the footy field of life. Neoliberalism has really redefined the entire game to the point where the game feels meaningless, because when you don't have umpires and rules, the game is pointless. And so people are now looking around for a better game, so to speak, you know, with defined rules, with a sense of belonging.
I mean, I think about your analogy of the umpires a lot, and the tech bro, I even hate to even call them that anymore. Let's call them the kind of techno-libertarians are looking for a world with no human umpires, right? They're looking for somehow the blockchain will automatically administrate everything.
Well, no, they do. They do subscribe. I mean, Peter Thiel, for instance, subscribes to this notion of the monarchy, you know, Yavin's, you know, kind of butterfly. Was it Butterfly Revolution? Was that the text that he wrote that sort of talked about this monarchy, you know, this monarchy setup where you get rid of democratic institutions and all this kind of thing, and you have this sort of godlike entity at the top, you know, globally.
Yeah, you go back to Queen Elizabeth, which they say was the best time in human history.
Don't know what history books they're reading. I mean, I know as an Australian, that's not a fantastic time for Indigenous people. They're not necessarily saying that the system will take care of things. They do feel that there's going to be some kind of powerful entity at the top, but just the one, you know? Right. And I think they're going to have a fair bit to say in it. These dudes, right, with their, you know, very narrow idea of what life's about.
They also see a great state shift. Right, to something else, as dramatic a shift as we're envisioning. It's just towards, you know, monarchy or feudalism or in, you know, and I think, I guess Musk, even in Musk's vision, he would administrate through artificial intelligence and things, but he would still be at the very top.
Well, he's, you know, he's a transhumanist, but he also believes that his genes, you know, should be spread, like certain genes should be spread and amplified, you know, through AI. And so it's a form of, you know, eugenics without a doubt. And it's just really interesting that these dudes, and they are all men, kind of think that the solution is, once again, you know, to go back to what we were saying at the beginning, to take the mindset that caused the problem in the first place, because they are detecting something that we've been detecting. The system's not holding. It's not working, right? There's all kinds of issues. They've kind of plugged into certain aspects of what's going on and said that that's the issue. And they're using the mindset that sort of caused them in the first place to try to solve it. And they're taking that to the absolute nth degree. And it's this, I don't know whether they truly believe it or whether they've locked themselves so far into the shark's mouth that they can't withdraw, right? You know, it's a form of that extinction burst where they have to kind of play out the drama that is actually collapsing. They've just got to put all they can into it. Like a toddler, you know, that basically says, stop throwing a tantrum and then just gives it one last blast, you know? And because they know that, I think they deep down know what we all know, and that is that this whole thing, this whole edifice is coming down. It is redundant. It doesn't hold. And so they're just going to capitalize the hell out of it. And their cognitive needs need to kind of keep this kind of weird alignment going that, oh, well, if we do this, then this result will happen. And they're so locked into that. I mean, I feel for them because I suspect that they've, and you've done a lot of work with these billionaires who are trying to sort of, you know, save themselves. They feel the same sense of dis-ease as we do.
Right. They're running the program to the end. And they see, oh, if we run the program to the end, especially if we accelerate it with digital technologies or AI or automation, it's really going to lead to oof. That's where it's going. So again, rather than being truly creative and thinking we can run a different program, they're going back to what you would call the Moloch program, really. Yes. As if from the beginning of the Axial Age, we set something in motion, you know, with a growth-based, future-based, even messianic future that we're going to get to the end of this game, and this really happening, so how am I positioning myself for impact? Rather than doing what I think that you're suggesting is, oh, well, what if we look back at the sort of the rules of that game, the mindset that we created then, and develop something better. Now we know where that goes.
Yeah, going back to home base, and which is our humanity and our connection with all the attunement we have with all of life, right? Which is really what I think you are experiencing in your workshop, your retreat, which is the messaging that once you do come back to home base and you have that visceral sort of communion with what is true, which is our body at the moment. Our body is the best, you know, sort of gauge for how we can navigate all of this. The messages come flooding in. You know, I had a similar experience and I write about it in my book. I don't go into great detail because I don't want to be one of those people that talks about my ayahuasca experience. Right. But I did, you know, have an experience just before I started writing the book and just before I moved to Paris to write the book. And I essentially went into it saying, is this what I am meant to be doing to be of service to humanity at this juncture in history, you know? And I went into it with all kinds of, you know, resistances because I'm quite a, you know, A-type, grippy kind of, you know, person. And It just did the most delightful thing. You know, it felt very maternal. And I got these drop downs of, you know, I was swimming around the primordial soup of life, you know, having almost a sort of a natal experience, you know, like I was in the mother's womb, you know, just experiencing all these sensations that felt very much like love. And I saw these atoms dropping down and I couldn't read them. So I had to come up into consciousness. I had to take this big, deep gasp and come out to read the letters. And, you know, I had got simple messages, Doug, like, yes. That was the first message, just spelt yes. And I went, Ah, of course. Awesome. Okay. And then I went back down again and, you know, these other questions, you know, and the answers just came out in these sentences, you know, like it was so blatant, you know, and I mean, really what it was saying. And I think, you know, we can tap into these experiences at every single moment when we come back to home base and are open to the idea of kind of setting out again in a better direction, then we just get sent in that better direction, you know? And I know it sounds very simplistic, but I'm with you. I really do feel that the awfulness of the direction that we're heading in is forcing us elsewhere. You know, it's like the George Costanza thesis of, you know, whatever you're doing, do the opposite and it'll turn out, you know. It's kind of a little bit like that. It's a wrong way, go back. Okay, that was the wrong way. Let's try something else, you know. And the something else is gentler. It's more powerful. It's embodied. It's stiller. It's less instead of more, yeah. more.
It's slower. And that's the thing. And I've been, as a child of the industrial age and mass media, I keep having the distortion that if you're not doing it at scale, you're not doing it. And now yeah. I've sort of realized that that's the illusion. That's the illusion of the industrial age, that change, mm-hmm. the genuine change only happens at scale, where actually, if we convince ourselves that we need to operate at scale, then we are disempowering our somatic, local, face-to-face, person-to-person experience.
Mm. It reminds me of that quote from Bayo Akamalafi. Have you had him on your podcast?
No, I should. That'd be great.
Yeah, yeah, he's awesome. There's the line, the times are urgent, let's slow down. I mean, it's just right. perfect. Even just the saying of it, you get it. You know, the times are urgent, let's slow down, you know, let's you, me and the universe slow it down and we'll get something far more powerful and capable of developing a momentum. When I write my books, I handwrite them first and I hike my book. Like all of my books, I've had to hike around the world and just be in movement. And, you know, I keep a piece of paper and an old school pencil down my bra and I set off. And every now and then, apparently Nietzsche did the same, not in a bra, but he had a walking stick that had a hole in it and he could stuff his bit of paper in there, pull it out and write his notes, you know, when he was hiking in the Swiss Alps. And, you know.
What tech taketh away, it can also giveth back. Think about it. We've handed our social lives over to platforms designed to keep us clicking, not connecting, turned human relationships into follower counts and reaction metrics. Our new favorite sponsor, Groucho, is a corrective. Founded by artists who want to flip the script, instead of atomizing us like a social network, they connect people in real life. Human curators place you in a local club with people who complement your interests and your journey. Share evenings out with your club twice a month until real connections take hold. Then, the people at Groucho place you into a new hand-assembled club for the social fabric to grow. Groucho wasn't built by tech bros, but artists who wanted to recreate the serendipity of their own art residencies, where they found lifelong collaborators, friends, even life partners. So come on, Team Human, let's find the others. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman.
Discerning thought, the part of the brain responsible for discerning thought, I'm really, really simplifying all of this, but the prefrontal cortex developed as we became a species that walked on two feet, right? You know, because we're able to get more food and feed a brain that enlarged and developed this particular part of the brain. And so that discerning part of the brain works best when we're doing things at a pace that is conducive and familiar. So walking is that pace, right? Because we emerged that part of the brain at the time we started walking. Equally, handwriting, which is a slowed down version of that sort of, you know, mad outputting of information, goes at the same pace. So I have to hike and handwrite my books to get the kind of decent enough content that I require. You know, I can't do it at scale, at full speed,
right.
tapping madly, just doesn't deliver.
Right.
And this is something that I'm really starting to realize. And it's really interesting. I know that there's a lot of people who are at a point where they're seeing what's happening in the world, and this idea of systems collapse is starting to really make sense. You know, they're seeing it, they're living it, we're in it. You know, it's all very, very meta. And it's a very hard thing, just speaking of this idea of letting go of the scale concept. It's really hard as an activist to accept that change is going to have to occur at a localized, intimate level, and to trust that the emergent properties that are embedded in those kind of dynamics will do their thing, you know?
But they will. That's the whole thing. That's the way nature works and mushrooms work and rhizomes work. That's the whole thing. And there's the double whammy is that when we start operating at the pace that capitalism wants us to, like I'm doing a Substack, the only way I would be able to actually make money doing my Substack would be, at least right now, would be if I did it at a pace that changed the way I write and ultimately supported the very thing that, you know, it's like when you write at this pace of the pencil, you engender that pace and all of the good things about that pace. You activate the right part of your brain and all. When I operate at the pace of Substack or whatever it is that the pace that it's asking me for as a platform, it feels like that part of the brain goes away and the industrial part.
You become didactic. I notice it. I become didactic. I'm telling people what to do. I'm like, that is not what I want to be doing at this point in history.
Right.
You know, but I'll show you like this is what my Substack posts look like, right? Mm. I mean, that's actually a neat version of things, but it then develops and, you know, I draw circles and it's, I can encapsulate an idea in one piece of paper and then I sit down and I obviously type it out.
You translate it, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And trust is a word, I think, that we're going to have to become very comfortable with. We've done the meditation retreats, we've had the therapy, we've read the books, right? We know these concepts and now we're being forced to live it because there's no other way. And so, I mean, I now see where I'm at as a sort of it's a process, it's a vigilant commitment to learning and being around these ideas. So reading books about it, speaking to people who are also exploring these things, you know, it's like becoming, and this is another topic I cover in my book, to be able to cope with what we're going through, we've actually got to become very uncomfortable with death because something is dying and it's going to be up to us what dies. And there's three entities that are up for it, right? There's the death or the collapse of the system. And not just one system, but the complex system of complex systems that make up the post-industrial civilization. That is going down no matter what. Like, it doesn't matter how many ways we try to plug the various systems. Every time we plug it, it spits out a problem elsewhere. You know, it destabilizes another system.
But it can go down in a number of ways, though. You know, it's like we can...
The whole point is we don't know.
But we can learn permaculture, reduce our dependence on fertilizer, or they can close the strait at the Gulf and we have to learn the hard way. You know, because the fertilizer can't get through.
That's right. We will either be forced into it abruptly, or we can, to quote Nate Hagans, we can simplify now. I think you've been on his podcast fairly recently. We can simplify now, right? So we can get on with these things so we can metabolize this collapse and kind of have a softer landing. So that brings me to the two other deaths. There's our own individual death. And I think, you know, ultimately that's what we all fear, the death of ourselves and our immediate family, our children, perhaps our parents and so on. And then there's the death of humanity, of our entire species and maybe some additional species on the way down. And those two latter deaths, I don't think we have to do, right? Like, they don't have to be part of this first death. And the choice is ours collectively, you know, and whether the whole thing goes down depends, and I sort of say this a lot in the book, on how we handle it. You know, if we can handle this, if we can hold what's going on, if we can have a mature outlook and we can, you know, soften the blow, move with it, simplify now, then we not only have a great chance of saving humanity, we have a great chance of taking humanity to its next level of maturity and evolution, which is, I think, what this is all about. And this is something that I have been nervous to talk about previously. You know, in the writing of the book, my deep, deep sense has been that this is going somewhere. You know, my mother came to me. I came out to Australia while I was writing the book, and, you know, we were sitting on the front deck, and she said, "Sarah, I don't understand. You know, my mother struggles with all of my work. You know, she has to disappear after one of my books comes out because it's just too overwhelming for her." And she said, "I don't understand. You're writing about these incredibly frightening ideas, but you seem happier than you've ever been before." And that is absolutely certainly the case, because I am taking on this information and it's making sense, and I'm metabolizing it through me. And I do believe that, you know, and what I really wanted to say to my mum, but it would really take her, you know, send it to church, which is generally where she heads with these things. She would, you know, it's that I believe this is heading somewhere. More than anything else before in my life, I believe this is heading somewhere. It is entirely necessary. I can see that all the patternings are required. They are necessary. The human entity has been crying out for this next evolution, and we're being taken there, and it's not going to be comfortable. And, you know, skill number one to develop in all of this is get comfortable with discomfort. Be the groundedness in the ungroundedness. That is step one in handling this shit. We are being taken somewhere. And as I say, you know, some of the concepts in my book, I was very uncomfortable about using the word fascism in the past, you know. But then, of course, by the time you know, the book's coming out in June globally, by the time it's sort of out there in the world, you know, I mean, like right now, right, we're in fascism. I think it's a term that we're all comfortable with. Ditto, I think, with what I'm talking about here and what you're really talking about when you were referring to your Kundalini experiences and everything. I think we are being forced into a new direction, whether we like it or not, whether we're ready for it or not.
Right. And it's going to happen. But then our choice is, how do we transition? How soft a transition can we engender? How few babies need to die during this transition? And we do have power over that. You know, I'm kind of living in the serenity prayer now between what do I have control over and what do I don't? Where can I make an impact and where don't I? And it's way more in the way this happens than in the what happens.
Yeah, this is the more interesting conversation that we do need to be having. We have
just
work
like,
to
get to work,
to,
right?
To
but
do.
This is Mara. This is the shadow preventing us from doing the thing that actually on the ground helps. You know, and I'm going to help from whatever position I happen to be in at the time. I've got precarity. You know, we a lot of us have precarity who didn't expect to have precarity given our privilege. The system is cracking to that extent. We're all in the same boat.
There's a line in the collapse community. We're all going to be living like the people who currently grow our coffee beans. You know, that's one way of looking at it. I don't know that it'll all end up that way within our lifetime. I'm not sure. You know, I think everything in this space has to be caveated with, I don't know.
Yeah,
we don't know. All we do know is it's going to get more uncomfortable. It's going to get worse. And, you know, all of that growth and betterment is going to reach zenith. We're already at that zenith, and it's going back down the other side. So if you can imagine that sort of bell curve, the angle that it's been going up at, you know, since kind of, so the late 1700s, it's going to go back down the other side at the same angle. And so, you know, we do know that. We know it's going to get uncomfortable. We know it's going to be less. But beyond that, we've just got to be in this discomfort. But as you say, like, I try to stop apologizing for being somebody who is saying all of this and having these kinds of conversations, and instead putting my time to what are we going to do about it? What are the next steps? So what do you think they are, Doug? What do you think we should be doing? What's the priority for most of us who are in our similar position?
For a lot of us, I do think I only know my own trajectory through it. And I was reminded of my trajectory when I read the book in its Substack form, because it followed how I went through it. I mean, starting with the problem of growth that began with the beginning of the axial age. You know, I'm a media theorist, so I look at it all in terms of the media environment, but we started to write things down. Once we wrote things down, we had a history and we had a future. And Abraham got this promise, right? If you don't sacrifice your child to Moloch, you know, I will give you all this stuff and Messiah is going to come and your family's going to be fine. Just cut off a little foreskin or whatever and call it a day. And it sort of initiated this very kind of book-like, Bible-like narrativity to human experience of this ends justifies the means. Just kill those Amalekites over there and then God will come. Do this and then God will come.
We've been in a dress rehearsal for eons, haven't we? This sense that it's all run up, you know? And that's the sense that we've got now, is the run-up's done. The dress rehearsal is over. We are in it now. And that's what feels so profoundly different.
Right. And then if you're in it now, I feel like what most of us need to learn is that doesn't mean that that whole last 2,000 years of narrativizing this reality is true. It doesn't mean that the world ends and the Messiah comes, or now you've got to pick which side you're on, or now it's like, oh, wait a minute. No, that narrative is over, that it's done, this growth-based civilization narrative that we exercise through capitalism and domination and colonialism and all those things. It's like the ends justifies the means thing was wrong to begin with. It's been in the moment. We kind of let ourselves get, and maybe it sounds intellectual, but I feel like we let ourselves get fooled by the illusion of linear time and took our attention off the moment that we're actually living in, which is where the majority of our transformative power actually rests.
But that's incredibly anxiety-inducing, because that linear time thing, all of the mythologies, right, that we've created have kept us suspended in a comfortable safety, because human consciousness can't deal with the truth. And the truth is that we will die, and in the meantime, we have freedom. You know, was it the dizzying effect of freedom, as Kierkegaard said? That is the definition of anxiety. But what I feel is happening now is that mythologies have been pulled, you know, the rug's been pulled out from underneath us. And it's a little bit like realizing, I remember sort of a moment when I was about 12, when I suddenly realized, oh my God, my parents are wrong. You know?
Yeah.
I fundamentally disagree with them. And I remember that sort of dropping out, you know, kind of this feeling of everything dropping out from underneath me.
And what'd you do?
Like, holy. Went and set up a tree, which was my solution for most things back then. Climbed a tree, sat up there and thought. That's what I used to do a lot in my early teens. My brothers all said, oh, yeah, no, Sarah was just up a tree planning out her future, you know, looking out to the horizon, which was pretty much right. They were all younger, and then they'd follow me up the tree to tell me lunch was ready.
It's interesting, because I'm thinking about that exact moment in my life when I realized this is all wrong, and I didn't realize the power, why I did it at the time. I turned to theater.
Well, I turned to God. I turned to God. We lived in the country, and I've written about this in one of my books. I used to get a lift into town with mum and dad, who were going to church on Sunday, and I would go and experiment with different churches. So I'd go and sit in, you know, after school, I used to go and sit in the Hare Krishnas, Seventh-day Adventists. You know, they all saw me coming with their clipboards, right? Like, you know, this 12-year-old going,
right.
I need God, I need
vulnerable
God.
Vulnerable state, and I read the prime target.
Yeah, exactly. The funny thing is, I also became a raging capitalist. I started my first business at 12. So there's all these things happening at the same time. And I developed my sort of first anxious disorder, quote unquote, right? I mean, fancy calling it a disorder. I was just a kid going, what the hell is this about? Yeah. Someone help me. Someone provide me with an answer. And I had this sort of two-pronged approach, spirituality and meaning, join the system and make money and find purpose through that.
Right.
You know? And I'd never swung off too far from one or the other. Two have existed in this kind of weird tension in my life ever since. So that's what I did. But I'm sensing it, and I think humanity as a whole is sensing it now. The kids in Gaza, you know, must be going, what the, I mean, the world-based order, you know, the rules-based order, that is gone. There's so, literally all the umpires have been kicked off the footy field, right? And now what? We are being asked to actually write our own rules, and that is frightening, right? A lot of people are going, oh, please don't give me that job. Please don't give me that job. We're not capable of it, you know? And it's a really big ask. And I think we need to clear the decks. Well, the decks are being cleared for us, right?
Right. And in the worst possible way, but
the most uncomfortable possible way. But I think it's the only way. We don't get the lesson until we're forced into it.
But we're saying the same thing that the Christian evangelists are saying, that, well, Trump is this troubled thing, but he's this necessary, you know.
Yeah, for the rapture.
Yeah, in order for the rapture to come. And we're saying, oh, well, we need this clearing of the decks for the great transition to happen. But I would argue that this is not the right way for this to happen. You know, I know the rules are wrong, but
Yeah, well, I think, though, it's not going to be a sudden rapture. And also, this is not separatist. It's not like some of us are going to be, what, suctioned up into heaven and the rest of us are left here to suffer. I mean, it's not going to look like that. It's also, yeah, and it's certainly not going to be sudden. I don't think collapse is like in the movies. You know, it's a little bit of a crumbling over here and then we kind of regather our senses and then it crumbles over here. I mean, in many ways, COVID was a really obvious start for people to, you know, to see all of this, right? It crumbled and everything got a bit shit and we couldn't get toilet paper and people had fights but there was beauty. People were singing opera on balconies and we kind of managed to claw it back a little bit and get a bit of stability again, but not fully. We didn't return to normal fully. And then off it goes again and there's another little node in the system that ruptures, you know?
Right.
That's what it's going to look like. So we're going to have, I think, time to calibrate around this, to metabolize. This is what we're in now. We're in this kind of sort of crumbling backwards and forwards, two steps down, one and a half steps back, that kind of a space. And it affords us the time to be able to, yeah, readjust and then also start to build, to quote Milton Friedman, the ideas that need to be lying around at the time that things do go to shit, you know? So by the time it does collapse and by the time all of those systems become fully redundant, right, they're just going to die out and we're all going to give it a round of applause as it goes, we will have something else in place, you know? We are in the liminal time now. This is the liminal time between the two worlds. In some ways, at a psychological level, this is the worst bit or the most confronting, difficult bit because it's a psychological, emotional, spiritual adjustment, you know? And, you know, who was it? Is it Gramsci who said we're in a time between worlds it's a time of monsters, you know? That's it. You know, I cast my hand wide to the world. This is what it looks like as we're grappling. And Trump and the tech bros, they're all throwing those ideas into the mix, right? We need to be throwing the ideas into the mix as well, you know, with embodied practices, with practices that are enabling of emergent forces and with conversations that normalize this again.
Yeah.
And it's really easy. It's an easy task in many ways because this is what the human species craves. This is what we are attuned to naturally. And so as you start to talk this kind of stuff, and I don't know if you find this, as I start to talk these ideas, at first people are a bit like, what the hell?
Right. And they act as if I'm saying, you know, oh, solve the world by going to a yoga class, you know?
But then as you start to talk through some of the principles and, you know, you've got to chuck in some kind of, you know, linear science and a few bits and pieces, you know, so that people grasp it, because that's where our sensibility is still positioned, right? In the old linear world. That's how we learned. That's how we trust knowledge.
Right.
So we've still got to have one foot in that camp still as we talk through all of this. But as I talk through it, the words, you know, the second chapter of my book is called Relief. Because people, as I started to talk about, I don't have hope anymore. Hope in the sense that is used so often, and that is that we can keep things as they were, as we can go back to normal. You know, the green economy and that whole transition, you know, dialogue is all about taking us back to where we were, right?
Exactly. It's like, don't worry, we can save the environment and capitalism, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it'll all be good. And we won't, you know, we won't put anybody offside. But that's because, and, you know, that is because people in the climate movement worked out we cannot dismantle the system to enable a real green economy, a real green system to operate. So they went, well, we're stuck in this system, so let's play by the rules and do what we can.
Right, which is old Democratic Party. That was perfect Al Gore, right? So with he understands there's a climate crisis, and he's like, well, we could use VC to invest our way out of it. Yeah.
Totally get it. I totally get it, because we were in, there wasn't time. There was not time to dismantle the system to rebuild this new way of thinking that could hold a truly regenerative, sustainable setup. But the wonderful news is, the system's going down, right? We don't have to do that first stage anymore. It's going down, and so there is this. It's going to afford a space for a truly sustainable, regenerative way of being.
But it's going down, kicking and screaming. It's not. It's. I mean, I get it. That, you know, the way to get off oil. Of course, our president in America would close up renewable energy just in time for us to have an oil shortage. You know, it's just like the opportunity for regenerative energy, which I know, and Nate Higgins would say, it's not going to solve the problems. You still need to just use less, which of course we do. But the only way to use less is to not be making stuff we don't need and then writing commercials for people to buy the stuff. You know, this sort of growth-based illusion thing that we're stuck in.
I'm totally with Nate on this. And I think his message, the idea of simplifying now, is the only, you know, the only sustainable, practical, tangible, workable form of prepping that we can do.
Right. And then, as you said before, and the way to convince, if I don't even like saying that, the way to engender a society where people want to do that is to show
make
that
it sexy.
Yes, that the people who are simplifying are having more sex, they're eating better food, they're having nicer poops. You know, it's just a better life.
But it works. It really works. Like, this has been my message for ages. I started off in you know, sort of with writing a book about quitting sugar. And it wasn't like a diet, because I was like, I've never dieted in my life. This is about just switching our patterning so that there's a win-win-win-win-win scenario, right? Your digestion sorts itself out. You might lose the weight that your body knows it needs to lose. You basically return everything to an equilibrium where it works itself out and you don't have to put all your attention on it anymore. You know, I mean, we know the word now, food noise, from the whole Ozempic craze, but that is, you know, that's what it did. And then, you know, sort of at 34, I'm 52 now, I kind of just was funneled into simplifying the hell out of my life. And I've lived out of two bags of belongings ever since. You know, I literally own four pairs of underpants. It's become a headline with the Daily Mail on several occasions. They've been fixated by that particular.
But you've switched them out over time. Yeah. You replace
one,
throw one out
dies,
and get it. Yeah.
While we still have underpants to purchase, yes, I do switch them out. But, you know, I'm wearing clothes still from when I was 18. I don't throw anything out.
Yeah.
And the more that you simplify, like I don't own a car, I ride a bike everywhere. Yes, I float around the world, but I've worked out these ways of just kind of being agile, you know. I use the bike share schemes wherever I go. I have I arrive wherever I am. I can live out of, you know, the backpack that's just on the floor here. I can live out of that for 6 months, you know? And so I arrive, I get on a, you know, I arrive at the train station, I get on a bike, I can go everywhere. All of that way, that, you know, that way of simplifying becomes a way of life. It becomes a muscle that you build up. And a lot of people say, oh, so it must be really hard living like that. I'm like, no. I do it because I'm primarily lazy. Like, I don't have time to organize, you know, I don't know, my kitchen drawers. I don't have patience for going shopping and developing a sartorial image or aesthetic. I just don't, you know.
Right.
So I shop like a man. I have had the same pair of shoes for about 15 years. I just replace them. They're now no longer making this particular style, so I now find them, you know, like seconds from around
right.
the world and buy two at a time and keep one lot in storage, you know, at my family's house so that they're, you know, like that's how I kind of live my life. And it's the same with eating. I keep it really simple. I don't, but and then it, you know, assists with stomach problems, you know, like it all does make sense.
Yeah. And it gives you so much more time and so much more joy. And
yes.
And, but the argument against it, which I don't agree with, would be sort of the, it would be almost a Bill McCaskill sort of article, argument against that. It's the only way out is through. And we're not going to get through if you're not supporting the system that's developing all the new things that are going to, in other words, that there.
Do you mean Bill McKibben?
No, Bill McCaskill,
Bill
the sort of
who's he?
He's the effective altruism that we've got to make.
Oh,
all
Will
this
McCaskill.
Yeah.
Will McCaskill. I've interviewed him on my podcast. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Which is a scary way.
Sam Bankman-Fried's.
Yeah,
sort of
I get, but part of what they're mentor. Saying, the implicit in what they're saying is the only way through is if Monsanto gets to the place where they can grow our food on a rock, and or you've got enough genetic engineering so that you can live with the radioactive waste. So don't you slowing down? You are no longer fueling the engines of capitalism and research and science and growth that are going to do that. So yes, keep your Amazon Prime account because that's paying for the space flights that are going to let Blue Origin go on an asteroid and get the helium to make mm-hmm. the chips for the AI that's going to make your baby not have cancer because it's been raised in a heavy metal toxic microplastic uterus.
Yeah, that's a techno-optimist argument, you know, and it's baffling. I went to – it's Cambridge, isn't it, that Will McCaskill's based out of?
Yeah.
I went to Cambridge and interviewed him. I went to his, you know,
right.
centre that, you know, he's got all that funding
that's
for.
That's why I mentioned
I wonder
it, because
where all that
you got more out of him than I would have been able to, because I would have stormed out or gotten upset and left.
Well, I've got to say I was kind of naive and a little bit like willing to sip at the Kool-Aid to kind of comprehend because I was trying
right.
to get my head into it. And I was walking around this kind of institute, you know, and there was beanbags everywhere and young people with whiteboards, you know, mind mapping stuff and all this kind of thing. And it felt, and I was like, wow, there's a shit ton of money going on here. I've since realized that the book that he wrote had something like $10 million worth of publicity put behind it, and it was coming from somewhere. I'm suspecting a Peter Thiel-like character. But then I went and interviewed Holden Konofsky, who's the longevity dude, like who's, you know, sort of adjacent to the effective altruism camp. And then I went and then Peter Singer, who
right.
influenced, you know, the effective altruists, you know, and I just went down this cascading kind of, you know, hellhole of circular thinking, you know, and it is really seductive. And what I realized, and I really had to come through this when I got stuck in this hellhole for about 6 months, literally did not move because I was trying to work out where it all fitted, right?
Right.
And the transhumanists, I interviewed a bunch of transhumanists as well who were all interconnected. And I realized there was this incredible matrix of thinkers who are all funding each other and all propping up each other's way of thinking. And it's incredibly circular so long as you stay in that limited system. As soon as you start to go, ooh, what about this externality over here? And what about this human tendency over there? It all comes undone. And, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried is probably an example of that. You know, look what happens when it's left to kind of run its course. It's an incredibly seductive world. Once again, they are trying to solve the same problem that you and I and everyone here is trying to solve, but it can't be solved with that kind of, you know, plugging the dike kind of mentality. But yeah, it is really interesting. You know that Will's wife, I think it is, girlfriend, de facto wife, she is the sort of the head of philosophy and ethics or something like that at Anthropic.
I know. I read that in your piece. Yeah.
Isn't that incredible? I didn't know I wrote about it. I write about things sometimes and then forget that I've written it.
But part of that makes me realize they mean well. They really do mean well. They don't want the world to end.
No. And I hate to say it, having met a bunch of these people, they're young, enthusiastic idealists, but they are also emotionally limited, if that can make sense. I mean, I think it's emotionally immature.
Right.
I don't know that. I think a lot of them, they've either been in mum and dad's dungeon or basement playing, you know, video games for most of their teenage years and have emerged with, you know, a mindset which is really like one of these video games, or they've been in academia and again, you know, sort of with a narrow mindset, you know.
And it goes back to that, though, the narrow mindset, it goes back to because, and they're smart, and I know what it's like to be smart, but then from the neck up, they're so smart.
Yeah.
And from the neck down, they haven't done that work, as if that work is, and I'll use this pejoratively, as if it's like women's work, you know, that or
woo-woo.
Animal or
it's woo- not going to get us anywhere.
Right.
Yeah. And it feels unsafe. That's it. It feels unsafe and unreliable. But I sense that a lot of them would be feeling an incredible cognitive dissonance because what they're talking about doesn't match up to what's happening, you know, in the world. And the cognitive dissonance, I mean, it's similar to the cognitive dissonance that I felt as a climate activist, peddling hope and then watching the headlines, telling
right.
people, hey, listen, if we all just switch to electric, we'll make it. And then realizing, hang on, we've missed the deadline, right?
Right.
So the cognitive dissonance was causing me so much pain. I had to do something about it. And I had to go down this kind of rabbit hole and research what was happening, you know, and sort of frame it as a meta crisis, as a sort of a Moloch situation, et cetera, and in terms of, you know, systems collapse. But everybody's feeling this way. We are cognitively exhausted from having to hold up a lie. And I think that these, you know, Will McCaskill's and so on, I think they're feeling the same way.
Right. So they're building bunkers and trying to get up there. You think they really want to
totally.
Upload their brain to a computer? I think they'd prefer to be here.
But they've gone so far into the shark's mouth, they can't get out now. They're too far into this.
Right.
They are too locked in. And so part of the journey that I sort of take in this book, can I hold up the cover, by the way?
Because
I actually got
sure.
sent.
Oh, great. Yeah.
This is what I meant to do. I get instructions from my publisher to do these kinds of things. But I got sent the, there we go, I Ate the Stars. But the funny thing is, it's got some self-help book, dummy copy in the inside. It's hilarious. It's
right.
just a dummy sort of thing at the moment. But part of the reason I wrote this is I went, there's two things that I think that need to be done in order to move forward as a species collectively in an emergent kind of rapturous, you know, dance. We need to understand what the hell's going on. And that does require staying in sort of the left brain mindset for a bit to kind of go, to be able to point at it and to name it. You know, this is what's going on. Then we, and part of the understanding process also enables a certain amount of compassion, because once you understand that this is systemic, it is the system, no one and everyone is to blame, then we can actually quit the pointing fingers at everybody and the anger, the anger that goes nowhere. We can quit all of that and put our energy to better things. It actually solves that cognitive dissonance, right? Once we understand things at a systemic level. So we need to sort of be talking all of this kind of thing and sort of acknowledging that these other people who are doing all these outrageous things, they're struggling as well, right? Because they're in the same system. And then we start to talk about what else. Once we realize that all of that is mythology, it's not an always already system, right? We can then give ourselves the freedom and openness and possibility to go and create something else. And that's the two sort of pronged approach that I take, you know, and we really do have to explain it. We really do have to point at it and then we move forward, you know. And the moving forward is quite simple. It really is. Can I ask you, I mean, I don't know how much more time we've got, but.
Whatever you want. I mean, we've satisfied the time requirements and the rest is gravy. So it's all good.
The rest is gravy. Yeah. It's the condiments. I don't know. I'd be interested to know what you're going to do next. I'm having a few conversations because I've reignited my wild podcast again. And I'm having a few conversations where I'm actually really intrigued with what people who have been, you know, at it for so long, what they're going to work on now that we're in this, you know?
Well, it's weird. I mean, I was thinking of writing a book called Embracing Apocalypse, How to Enjoy the End of the World and Maybe Save It in the Process. But I feel like I Ate the Stars accomplished certainly 80% of what I wanted to do in there. So I have to think.
There's room for more.
I know, but you may have done it. You may have done it, and in which case there's something else. Between that and hospicing modernity.
Vanessa Andreotti.
Yeah, who's you know, goddess incarnate, just, oh my God. It's like, where do I go? And part of, I think, what I may want to do, although I don't know how I'll stay alive exactly, but what I may want to do is model the thing I'm talking about, which is to operate not at scale, to operate face-to-face, live. I've got my job teaching at City University of New York, you know, a local public school, be there, be live, maybe, you know, do my podcast, and accept that in some ways the age of the book is over. The book as we know it, you know, here's this dude and he said the thing, here's the book, this is the form factor. It's like, let that go. I don't know, but definitely I want to, whatever I do, I'm very focused on the way in which I do it. I want to work breathing the whole time, you know?
Yeah.
I'm also thinking about maybe making a TV show, which I haven't done. It can reach our TV show or a YouTube show. And Gen Z are the people that are going to be charged with doing this. And I don't know that I'm reaching Gen Z by writing books. I'm reaching us. I'm reaching, but I'm not, yeah. I don't know that I'm reaching them. So I've got to think about that. And I've only switched, you know, Team Human finally became video this year. So we're making the video Team Humans, and then making the video Team Humans is really the excuse to make these 2 or 3 minute YouTube, Instagram, Reels, you know, TikTok clips that really do, if I do a podcast that reaches 25 or 40,000 people, but then a clip that reaches 300,000 kids, and that I wouldn't have gotten that 3 minutes without the hour and a half conversation, you know, the clip that comes out of this, I'm thinking about that. But I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because my kind of parting question to you was going to be not exactly what keeps you up at night, but I mean, where's your challenge now? Where's the unresolved spot? Where's your point of friction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's kind of the same question, but coming at it from different angles in some ways. And my point of friction is probably could be summed up as trying to switch the gears, you know? We're in this liminal, I draw in my book a congruent, was it? What are they called when your two circles cross over each other?
Like a little Venn diagram.
Yeah. So there's the old world and the new world, and where they cross over is this liminal time that we're in. And, you know, we have a foot in the old world and a foot reaching out to the new world. And that's very much where I'm at. So what keeps me angsty, you know, and sort of feeling like I'm not quite there, is this sense that, you know, is just trying to rectify that tension and then accept that the tension is exactly where I need to be, you know, really settling in to the discomfort of all of this, being the groundedness in the lack of groundedness, you know. And part of it that what does help is realizing that I'm a mid-age woman, you know, a crone, you know, like I'm stepping into an era where women, I think, really come into their full power. Menopause is this incredible gateway, you know, this incredible opening. And so I'm in all of that. I'm sort of perimenopausal and sort of in this tumultuous, you know, liminal space. And I'm really just trying to be in that. And to sort of tie it into what I was trying to get at with the question I asked you, I'm speaking to a bunch of women. So Vanessa Andreotti was one of them. There are a bunch of other women in their 50s, who have written all of these sort of, you know, I spoke to a woman who's coming up on my podcast who is a Turkish dissident, exile. And she's written all these books about fascism, right? For years and years, she's become this, you know, done the circuit, done the book, you know, this material sort of thing. And she really, her thoughts really replicate what you're saying. Her next stage is just being available and being able to embody this knowledge. And she said, I can't write. So her latest book is a far more emotional read. It's about how we're all going to become exiles, essentially, exiles from the matrix, the meaning matrix that we used to call home. And so what we need to be doing is learning from exiles that are being spat out of the system currently, right? So that's her thesis. And she's really saying, I'm, you know, she has to live between Greece and Germany, and she's away from her family and everything. But she said, I'm just available now. She said, I'm not going to start another project. I am going to be available to share the information that I've gathered and to live it out. And she said, you know, somebody's invited me to work on an art project in the Netherlands. Somebody's worked asking me to help out with a theatre project that's all in and around this kind of information. Yeah. That is, I feel, where I need to head. I feel it's what you're saying
it
as
is,
well.
It is, actually.
Like the frantically creating more projects is not the right way anymore. We've arrived.
My life is what has happened to me in spite of my best efforts to prevent it through choice.
Yes. Yeah, me too.
So now what if, I mean, how much does the universe have to tell me we got your back for me to go, take it, take me, you know?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. There's a wonderful woman wants me to direct a devised theater piece based on Jodorowsky's Psycho Magic. Better project for me at the moment I'm discovering magic and want to get back to theater to just, that door opened, you know, just and walk in it, you know, and without the guilt or embarrassment of like, no, it's like I've worked hard. I've really worked hard for the last 35 years. The fact that it sprouted another generation of people who happen to have been exposed to my stuff in school or here or there, and then now want to work with me, take that. I mean, remember William Burroughs in that last period of his life? It's like, oh, he's in a movie, he's doing this.
And yeah, none of it made sense.
Yeah, you just go with that.
But for anyone listening or watching this, I would say that, yeah, because, you know, you and I are in a fortunate position where we're creatives, and so, and it's also been tricky because we've had to create what we do out of thin air to kind of, you know, have a salary. But for anyone listening who's in a traditional type of job, you know, with a salary, what I say to people like that, you know, which is the bulk of humans out there today, is start where you are. You know, it's that whole Pema Chodron phrase. You know, if you are a nurse and you are doing that work and you love that kind of work, that's what you do. Start where you are. Start embodying a new way of being within the work that you're doing. The same if you're a teacher, if you're a team leader in some kind of company. We can all be entirely creative and kind of fuck the system,
right,
somewhat within what we're doing, because we are in this liminal time.
Right. Or even just fractionally creative. Look, each day, if you're doing marketing for this product you don't like, that's exploiting this, that's doing that, that's not doing well with labor, that's rotting kids' teeth, whatever it is, you have, look for one moment during the day where you can just tweak this teeny bit.
And keep coming back to your body. Keep refining how you use your body to give you the messaging. You know, James Hollis, the psychotherapist who's, you know, written a whole bunch of books, I think he gave me one of the greatest wisdoms I've ever received. And that is, you know, your body, your soul is calling you to your appointment with life. Okay. And it'll start as a little kind of 3 a.m. like niggle. And then it'll be a kind of a really obvious sign, you know, like, and then it gives you a shove. You'll get a sickness or you'll lose your job or whatever it is. It will keep going at you. Your soul will keep going at you until you step up and meet life and turn up to that appointment. So to be able to not land in that position, and I think a lot of people are developing illnesses and resistances and angst because I think their souls are calling them to an appointment with life and they're not listening. And so if you can refine your relationship with your body, whether it's going to you're learning meditation, going out for a walk in nature, you know, it doesn't have to be a big hike. Just go to somewhere where there's trees and walk in it and it does its thing. Try to refine your relationship with your and learn how to listen to those signs. And they're a lot more obvious than you think, you know? Yeah. It will help you. Your body will help you. It took me a long time to know how to read my body, and now it is my greatest, greatest asset, to be honest.
Yeah, I didn't read it at all, you know, which is fine. And I managed pretty well without, but the things I did were so much more complicated than they needed to be. I came up with great intellectual justifications for how, you know, and I applied them.
It's probably what your intuition knew all along, and you could have gone straight there if you knew how to read it, you know?
Right. So it is simpler. And your soul won't stop either, is the good thing. It's no matter what you've done. I know I sound Catholic or something, but I don't mean it like that. I mean, no matter what you've done, how far away from it you've gone, how alienated you are, your sort of your core commands or soul juice thing is still right there. It's still right there.
And
it's
will
just not
reward
here.
You
it will.
When you steer yourself in the right direction again, you know, and you can start to listen to that kind of thing. It'll be like little tweaks in your body. Your body will feel like it's kind of feeling healthy and aligned. So anyway, so that's, to answer that sort of ultimate, that final question that you posed, that's something that I'm still fine tuning. That's what keeps me awake at night. And it's not a bad thing to be working on, you know, like I know that that is what I'm meant to be doing. I don't have to try so hard. It's really the artfulness is in being slower, more delicate, more energized, more available.
Right.
Less attached. It's all of those things that the spiritualists and the philosophers have been saying for thousands of years. Like it's not that complicated.
It's not. But the beauty of the fact that those of us who've kind of had some of these insights and experiences that we're still addicted to production and growth and all is that there's such an abundance of writing and video and workshops and things out there from all of us recovering workaholics, that it's a great moment to rediscover what we're here for.
I agree. Great time to be having these conversations.
Yeah, totally. And thank you. Oh my gosh. Thanks so much for your work, for what you do, for the life. I listen to your podcast, and this should not sound at all like any shade. I listen to it for the way it sounds, for the way it sounds, yeah. for what you put the buds in and just feel it in my body.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm not a natural podcaster at all. I'm a very nervous person and I'm not a natural performer. And so if I'm being interviewed, I'm quite comfortable because it's like, oh, you're interested in something that I am obsessed by? Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, I sort of feel like an imposter. So it's not my preferred forum, but I do it because of the fact that I can get access to different people. I'm a very persuasive email writer. And so I feel like I kind of keep doing it while it's kind of working. So yeah, thank you. That's really, I don't quite know what you mean by that.
I mean, I'm listening to it for the somatic hit, you know,
okay.
more than the, yeah. the information for me is more validation than like, sometimes
yeah,
it's
you know
brand new.
You know the stuff.
So yeah, I've been in the stuff, but I'm moving into a different reason, and it's nice, put it that way.
Yeah,
it's
thanks.
Nice to listen to you.
Yeah. I'm going to reflect on that. All right. Well, Doug, it's all back at you.
Yeah.
Please keep going forward and please keep doing all these experiments to kind of access the embodiment of the stuff that you've shared with us, you know, make it sexy.
I will. Oh, I'm going to make it sexy. It's coming, baby. All right. Let everybody know. What do I say? Get I Eat the Stars. Pre-order it. What's that? I have the subtitle here. How to Live Fully and Beautifully in a Collapsing World, which is, that's the best thing you can do right now. Live fully and beautifully in a collapsing world and just watch the way the flavor and texture of the collapse changes. The collapse is not the problem. We've all fallen down. It's been fine. You don't even have to get injured. You can change that if you do it fully and beautifully. This is Team Human. You can get the ad-free version of this show by going to patreon.com/teamhuman. And supporting us. You get all sorts of other things. We're doing live premieres now, and we air the episode on an evening for the first time, and then I'm there afterwards to talk with you all about it. We have a Discord. We do some live events that you can come to for free, and you just get to be part of this in a way that helps us. So please consider it. You've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.